The last time I saw you, it was on the occasion of the Rabbi of Lud, and I talked to you in your hotel room. I think it was the Saint...
No, it was here.
No, I don't believe so.
I know it was.
No, I think you were here on the occasion of the Magic Kingdom.
Ah, you're right.
Yeah, and then when the Rabbi of Lud came out, I went over to your hotel, and the reason I recall it was that your wife was desperately ill.
Right.
Oh,
right,
she was right. So sick.
Well, three times the charm.
And she sat in the adjoining bed. We sat on one bed.
Well, I remember.
And she was in the other bed.
That's right.
And the phone kept ringing. And
she had what she lovingly refers to as the Green Death.
Oh, yeah, she was really sick, really ill.
Well, she's much better. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah. The first time I talked to you, when you said that you had MS, of course, I thought it was muscular sclerosis or something like that. I had never heard of it. But after I talked to you, I phoned the MS Society here to get more information so that I knew a little more about it so I could report intelligently after our conversation. You have kept busy in a... In a different way, you know, in a way that I would assume the when you wrote the MacGuffin, you know, you immerse yourself in it. It becomes another world. You almost transport yourself away from the everyday.
Well, but I mean, even if I didn't have multiple sclerosis, I would have written one book or another, and the same thing would have happened. I would have transported myself. I'd rather be, you know, someplace else anyway.
But you started, certainly you started writing before you were diagnosed as having MS.
Oh, yeah. I've been writing since, I can't remember when. I mean, my first book was published in 1964, and I wasn't diagnosed until 1972.
The MS is something you can draw on. In the MacGuffin, for example, I have to remember the names of the characters, the city commissioner.
Bob O'Gruff.
Yes, has some, many of the symptoms that you have had, including a bypass and this sort of thing. So in a way, you can milk the things that happen around you and to you. Isn't that true? I guess a writer always does that.
Well, I don't always do that. I mean, to a certain extent, Druff is me, but it's, and physically, in many respects, he is me. But psychologically, I guess, the book began when I was in the coffee room in the English department, and I started to notice that people were patronizing me, condescending to me, opening my doors and giving up their seats on the bus, and were patient with me, too patient with me. And I felt in a way that I was losing force, edge, intelligence. And it occurred to me that this would make a nice plight for an ordinary man like Bob O'Gruff, who is a politician and for whom power is the only game in town. And when a politician loses force, he loses everything. That's really the genesis of the book.
Is Bobo your first politician? You've written about so many different occupations over
the
years.
Well, I always really do begin with a...
I'm going to have to get a little closer to you. I can... I am not hearing you. I'm not hearing you. Of course, I have a hearing loss in my left ear, so that I have to get a little closer. Would you start again?
And saying what?
No, I ask you about the occupation seemed to be...
Oh, well...
Part of the... The way, also part of the way you start a book.
Always, always. I mean, I wrote a book about a professional wrestler before I ever knew what professional wrestling was all about. I wrote a book about your business, about
the Dick Gibson Show.
Right, an itinerant radio personality. Before I knew anything about radio, I wrote a book about a bail bondsman and so on. I do begin to... With a vocation, because the vocation ultimately becomes a metaphor for whatever it is I find out I'm trying to say. And I may be repeating myself, but The MacGuffin is essentially a book about a man who feels himself losing force. He's a politician. And again, force is the only thing he has to play with. Edge. He's not the kind of politician who goes out and has to get elected. He's an appointed fellow. He's a city commissioner of streets in a town of about a million or so people. And so he's riding on empty. And as he's riding on empty, it occurs to him that he needs something to do. And what he does is essentially is his life. He falls into a mystery, and the book is about Bob Woodruff trying to solve that mystery.
Yes, and there are a lot of people involved in this mystery too, which involves the smuggling in of Persian carpets.
Right.
There is a mysterious death involving a Lebanese girlfriend of Babo's 30-year-old son.
Mikey,
yes. Who
at Michael, but Michael insists that his people call him Mikey.
Mikey, and of course Mikey calls his father Daddy, which is kind of unusual for a 30-year-old man. He has, I guess you have to call it a two-night stand. The action, though, is compressed within, I guess, about 2 days.
Huh? Right. It's something like just under 2 days, about 38 hours or so. And he says, my God, I'm observing the unities. He never leaves town. He never leaves the, it's a kind of Aristotelian unity of place, time, and action. And that's because the spirit of narrative in the form of the MacGuffin has taken over his life. And you know what a MacGuffin is?
Well, no, I do not.
Well,
I began to figure it out, though, as I read, and I think you gave us at the very last page a pretty good definition of it, but I probably am going to ask you to amplify it. The definition if MacGuffin was the principle of structure to Druff, of pattern and shading and all the latent architecture of the old man's life, what was Druff to MacGuffin? A raw material like pitch, like tar, like clay or sand, or silica, like gravel, and the trace elements of all the asphalts.
Yes, he's city commissioner of streets, and all of those things have to do with roads. But essentially a MacGuffin is Alfred Hitchcock's term for anything which drives and structures a narrative. In this case, what I do is give MacGuffin a kind of personality of its own. And when it occurs to Druff that he finds himself, you know, like Cary Grant in a plot, inside a plot, the term MacGuffin occurs to him because it's really a term which is known, not known to everybody, but it's not really unfamiliar. It's not unfamiliar to Druff, and he starts thinking in terms of MacGuffin, and begins to anthropomorphize the thing until finally it takes on a personality and begins to talk to him.
I began to see the MacGuffin as kind of an alter ego in some form.
Right, Right. It is kind of an alter ego. But for Druff, again, who needs something to interest him so that he can engage, so he can do the isometrics of battle with just day-to-day existence, he personifies this MacGuffin and finds that he's never been so alive in his life now that he has a mystery to solve. And at last, the mystery gets kind of close to him.
I did not know the term MacGuffin. I looked it up, however, in the dictionary, and guess what?
What?
It was not there.
Well, it's in the Truffaut's biography of Alfred Hitchcock.
And that's where you ran across the term?
I knew about the term, but I Hitchcock says there's an anecdote about MacGuffin. A couple of Scotchmen are on a train, and one is holding a box, an elaborate-looking box, and the other says, "What's in that box?" And the Scotchman says, "Well, I have a MacGuffin in the box." "Well, what's a MacGuffin?" "MacGuffin keeps elephants away." "Well, there are no elephants in Scotland." He says, "Well, then, this can't be a MacGuffin in the box." That's a kind of lame joke, but when Hitchcock applied the term, he meant it in the sense that Jimmy Stewart will walk into the gents, the railway terminal, and he's washing his hands and set down his briefcase, and somebody else comes in and is washing his hands and puts down a briefcase which is more or less identical to Stewart's. And then when they're both drying their hands, Jimmy Stewart picks up the wrong briefcase. And presumably there's something in the briefcase which then generates the plot. The bad guys start following Stewart, and Stewart, unaware that they're following because he has this briefcase in his hands, doesn't know really what's happening to him, and things get, you know, kind of serious. Well, in a sort of way, that's what happens to Druff when Druff discovers that he has, or thinks he has, a spy.
I'm going to scoot you up just a little closer to this.
Right.
When I'm an inveterate reader, and I read 1, 2, sometimes 3 books a week, usually fiction.
You're not only an inveterate reader, you're a fast reader.
I'm a very fast reader, which is not always wise, but then I also do a broadcast about books 5 days a week, which is a great impetus. It's almost like being back in college.
Yeah.
I also get narcolepsy sometimes. I'll be reading, and I'll just fall asleep, you know, and I try to force myself to read some more, you know, and I'll fall. Eventually, I'll make it, but that was the way in college, in the 50s, when I was in college, I would
be reading. How many times did this put you out?
What's that?
How many times did this one put you out?
Well, it put me out a couple of times, but it was an entertaining enough book that I got right to the bottom of it. But the point I was trying to make was that there is usually a rhythm that I, as a reader, develop. And sometimes it's the author who creates the rhythm. So, but there are places where you like to pause, where you like to go up, go to the bathroom, get yourself a soda, or refill your martini, or something like that. So I'm reading the MacGuffin, and I'm beginning to say, well, it's time for a pause.
Are you referring to the fact
that... So I said, well, I'll wait till there's a break. I'll wait till the next chapter, so I'm going through.
There are no chapters.
And there is no chapter.
That's right. The book is, whatever it is, 280-some-odd pages, 60-some-odd pages. And I deliberately determined, you know, to make this a continuous action. And with the exception of a rather long flashback to Druff's days at the university, I did it.
Where did you stop? Where did you take your breaks?
Well, I took my breaks at 3:30 in the afternoon, which is when I stop writing.
But don't you find there? Of course, as you read it, there are places where breaks could be taken because the book is made up of a series of episodes. You could stop it at any episode, can't you?
No, I don't think so. I think that one episode feeds into the next.
But you had to stop at one point during the writing of the book.
Well, I mean, I didn't write the book at one sitting. I knew enough about where my characters were going and where what the book was about that I could just keep on spinning this. I made a series of things I wanted accomplished. Just little brief notes to myself of the bases that I wanted the characters to touch, or at least put Truff to touch. And all I had to do was, you know, go from first to second to third until hopefully he came on home and scored a run.
The last book that I read that did what you've accomplished here was Gerald's Party by Robert Coover.
Oh, yes.
Did you read that book?
Yes.
Yeah. But what he did a little differently, although it was nonstop in the way the MacGuffin is. He began to build the pace of the book so that by the time you reach the end, you were running furiously. He started rather slowly, and then the book built in momentum. So the sentences seemed shorter, the words seemed shorter, the action faster. Yeah. So that by the end, it was just like almost like a nonstop hallucination.
Well, at the end of this book, of course, Truff is an exhausted man. And he is quite literally going up to go to bed. And he almost can't make it up the stairs. He's so tired. So I think that all the activity is what ultimately drains him. And the fact that he solves the mystery provides him with provides him with an opportunity to come together with his family.
Are you still able to work in a teaching schedule?
Oh yes, fortunately I have a chair at Washington University and I teach in the fall. And I'm off during the spring semester.
So I'm sorry?
I teach 3 months a year, and I'm off the other nine.
Uh-huh. Now you mentioned to me, though I think the last time we talked, it was more and more difficult for you to get to the campus, but are you still actually teaching at the campus? Or?
Well, I have my graduate students come to my house, and I go to campus to meet the undergraduate class because they're simply too many people in that class. You know, I don't have enough chairs for them in the living room.
When I was in college, my creative writing professor was a man that you may have run into over the years, although he's dead now. His name is Hollis Summers.
Oh yes, I didn't know him, but he was the brother of the chairman of my English department, Joe Summers.
Well, I took creative writing. I was a journalism major, but I made the mistake of taking creative writing as well. Very difficult to reconcile journalism and creative writing and to do all of the things that you have to do while you're in college. It's just, I think college students must have an enormous amount of energy. I had to turn in a story, a short story, every 2 weeks to Hollis, but then I spent hours at the campus radio station, and plus all of the other classes that one had to take. So my stories became progressively worse. The first one or two stories were fine. I spent more time on them. But I mean, you could spend a year on a short story.
Indeed.
And to turn one in every 2 weeks was very difficult. I feel badly about what he had to read of mine. But he had such a gentle way.
Maybe that's why he died.
No, I don't think so. No, he had cancer. He had a gentle way with him. I would turn in a story, and if my language was vague, he would write, "I can't hear."
Huh.
And if I wrote something that was adequate or good, he would write on the margin, "This pleases me." And he was such a gentle man from Kentucky, with this gentle Kentucky accent, that I always remembered it. I remembered, and in our class.
You taught in Ohio.
At Ohio University.
Yeah.
Taught at the University of Kentucky, and then he was finally tenured at Ohio University. And I think I took two semesters, maybe one semester, I can't remember now. There were one or two good writers in the class, better than I, certainly. But generally, if you're a student, you have to write what you know. And when you're a student, you don't know very much.
That's why I tell my students not to write what they know, to make it up.
That would have been terrific advice. That would have been, I wish he'd given me that advice. But the problem is they make up science fiction stories.
They often do, and when they do, I, you know, break their pencils. But I think it's a kind of mistake to write what you know. As you say, an 18-year-old kid doesn't know a whole hell of a lot. But what he does know is monstrously interesting to him and not of much moment to the person who has to read it. You know, is Susie going to go out on the date with me or not? Who cares? Well, obviously, the kid who invites Susie out on the date cares, but no one else does. It's not important enough. And writing is very difficult to teach, and I really finally think it can be taught. But what I try to do in my classes is to teach students to create situations in which something happens to the character which forces him to get off the dime, which forces him to take some kind of action. Frequently, you know, they will turn in stories about madmen. Well, and I will, you know, say, no, you can't do that, because a madman isn't forced to do a damn thing. I mean, he's obsessed, he's compelled, he hears voices, the voices tell him to go, you know, kill Frenchman. But that's totally arbitrary. On the other hand, if the guy walks home and finds out that you know, his wife is packing, and he says, "Where are you going?" And she says, "Well, I'm tired of living with you. I'm leaving you." And he's still in love. He says, no, but please don't leave me. Please don't leave me. He has to do something. And then she does something in response to whatever it is that he does. And that builds a plot. That makes a situation. This is simply event shoving somebody off the metaphorical dime into action.
Oh, I think you're right. Motivation on the part of the characters is vital. That's why I feel that books that have homicidal maniacs running around, they have no reason to do it.
Right.
They're just,
anything can happen at any time, and that becomes a kind of chaos, incoherent.
Well, sometimes the police procedure in tracking them down is interesting.
And it's not about the Looney Tune. It's about the
police procedure.
Right.
But to go back to the 18-year-olds, actually, they do have a lot to say. The problem is that at age 18 or 20 is that they can't sort it out. It's too new to them. It's still, you can write, I think I look back at my childhood now with a much greater degree of clarity than I ever could when I was a child or a teenager or a college student.
Yeah, but the only things that 18-year-olds want to talk about are their glands. And it seems to me that there isn't a whole hell of a lot of point in glandular fiction.
I don't know. It always seems to be used. You have used glandular elements in the MacGuffin all the way through.
Then I take it back. There's a lot of glandular fiction.
But of course, MacGuffin is not about glands.
No.
Although it includes elements of glandular fiction within. So.
But I was going to say that the 18-year-old who has experienced his childhood has not really experienced his childhood, not yet. Because he's only experienced it when he's come to terms with it. And he only comes to terms with it when he's a full-fledged adult. And also in a kind of way, a full-fledged adult still sucking on the thumb of his kiddiness is sort of boring. It's too narcissistic. One has got to forgive one's past and get on with things.
Well, there are two sorts of novels that I'm skeptical about. One I dislike intensely, the other I have an open mind, more of an open mind about. One, of course, is the coming of age novel.
Right.
We all come of age, and I've read so many coming of age novels and seen so many coming of age motion pictures that they're not too surprising, especially coming of age books or movies set in the 60s. Which by that time I'm an adult, you know, it seems so near to us.
So arbitrary. I mean, people come of age, you know, in the 60s and the 50s and the 90s, and in the next century they'll be coming of age in those 50s and 60s and 90s. And they all come of age in the same way. They
yes.
come of age when something bad has happened to them. When they learn that, you know, life is not... a party.
The other type of fiction that I can't abide anymore, it's the generational novel. Usually it's a Jewish generational novel. It starts out in Tsarist Russia. The family flees through Europe and London. They come to New York. They work in the garment industry. They become successful, and the young ones wind up in a kibbutz in Israel. And I've read that so many times that generational novels
Mary Gordon wrote a general... Wasn't it Mary Gordon who wrote a generational novel about the Irish?
Now, same story.
It's exactly the same story. Nobody ends up in a kibbutz in Israel, but they end up in police departments. I don't know.
That's right. It's basically the same story. Well, what is... tell me a little bit about the actual process of writing, especially with your handicap. I guess you must use a...
I would use a word processor. Like everybody else. Mm-hmm. And my handicap really doesn't affect that. As a matter of fact, my handicap is peculiarly... it couldn't have, in a kind of way, have happened to a better guy. I'm suited to my handicap. I mean, I was a writer before I had this handicap. And so since one writes sitting still at a desk in front of a machine, that's what I did before, and that's what I do now, and I hope I can do it for as long as they let me.
Well, I trust that Apple Computer hasn't called you on the title of the book, because Apple has sent anybody who uses Mac... as a name for something, Apple Computer, you know, they make the Macintosh computer.
Apple... Well, I mean, I believe you, but I...
I was being kind of facetious that Apple would say, hey, you can't use MacGuffin. It cuts into our trade name, the Macintosh.
What about McDonald's?
On 192, I think there's something that I like the way you express this, too. And it was a parenthetical thought. And you write, life goes on. Indeed it did. It wasn't only the brushing and flossing, the taking of pills and making sure you had stamps. It wasn't just buying batteries for your wife's hearing aid or carrying a handkerchief or any of the rest of the light housekeeping of existence. It wasn't only coincidence or chaos or the scrambled randoms and broken code It was this. Mostly it was this. The deep, hidden peristaltics of mood, its titles, its sink or swims. Life goes on, saving a specific threat to the system, its pull on adrenaline. There is no such thing as priorities. Life goes on. Having a MacGuffin didn't change that. Who thought otherwise was a chump. Mm-hmm. And I can almost take that out and frame it.
Well, do it.
Life goes on. It certainly is going to go on for you, and you're going to turn out more wonderful books, Stanley Ulkin. It was great seeing you this time around. Good luck tonight. I hope that you come out a winner. But if you don't, the nomination was certainly another honor. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.